Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition. It wasn't done enough.
Manton Reese, I know the day has finally come tomorrow, the day you've been waiting for, your opportunity to invest in Twitter, publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange starting Wednesday. We're recording Wednesday, starting Thursday, November 7th.
Yeah, I'm going to be setting my alarm just like if a new iPad was coming out, right? I'm just going to be ready to jump on that, call my stock guy that I don't have. I'm going to pass on the Twitter stock, but it's exciting.
It is. Wow. It's a benchmark in the maturity, the maturation of that company, right? Mm-hmm. Especially from your perspective. I mean, you were on Twitter before I was. So, By quite a distance, I think.
I'll always have that 3-digit user ID. I'll always have that, if nothing else.
You will always have your 3-digit user ID that you abstain from using. You're like you're wasting a loyalty card. What if Twitter said, "All right, everybody who has a 3-digit or less user ID, we're going to start paying you to use Twitter. We'll give you Twitter stock. We'll give you 1,000 shares of Twitter stock. All you have to do is prove to us that you still care about Twitter and, tweet once a month."
Right. Well, I've made a big deal about how I'm not going to post to Twitter anymore with my personal account, but I've actually gone back just in the last couple of days and dusted off a couple of my business Twitter accounts. So I hadn't posted to any of those either. I had, at Riverfold, at Tweet Library, at Clipstart, at whatever. I had too many. And I decided to start using the at Tweet Library again because, well, two reasons. One, I shipped a new version of Tweet Library and I wanted to post about it on Twitter. But more importantly than that, I would still get at replies, like support replies to that, right? And I started to feel really bad. When I shipped the Tweet Library, I logged in and I hadn't logged into Twitter in forever with that account. And there was, a couple questions, some recent and some from a while ago. And, that's terrible customer support if someone's trying to use what they think is an official channel and they didn't get the memo that, no, I'm not on Twitter
anymore. When the app they're trying to use is a Twitter client.
Exactly. Yeah. So that would especially be harsh if they replied to one of those accounts using my actual app and then didn't get a reply.
You're like, sorry, please contact us on app.net.
Right. Well, and so on my personal account, I'd say that in the bio. The bio says, go to app.net and ask me questions. And I get questions on app.net about my Twitter app. And that's cool. Some people are on both. But so I decided to start using some of those a little bit, and there's no other way to go about it. I get questions every once in a while on those accounts. It's useful to be able to at least post a link when a new version comes out for customers that are following that and expecting the updates to be there. So
now, don't you think this could be a slippery slope? I mean, you start to kind of get the taste of that app.net is wonderful, but Twitter has. What, does it have a billion users, do you think? Nah, it can't have like 1/6 of the, 1/7 of the world's population.
Well, doesn't Facebook have a billion?
Yeah, but Facebook is, well, I guess it does, so yeah.
Well, I think someone from Twitter even like a couple years back, there was like that race to a billion, and Twitter, I think, made a claim that we'll hit that first. And I think you're right, I don't think they have hit that. I think they're still in the hundreds of thousands, hundreds of millions, but either way, lots of people. I don't think it's a slippery slope. I'm still very clear about not posting to Twitter, and that's my little. It's stupid. People are probably laughing hearing this, but that's my little protest.
I'm laughing as hearing it, but I don't mean it disparagingly. It's cute, Manton.
It's cute. Yeah.
No. I am totally in your mode of thinking when it comes to personal not vendettas, but it's not even a vindication, but it's like you have worked out in your mind a way of behaving that somehow offsets the perceived wrongs of mm-hmm. the platform.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
It's my little statement.
I can respect that. I mean, I do lots of... I do lots of stupid little things as if to suggest that your stance is one as well. But I do lots of things that I recognize that somebody else would look at it and say, like, why are you even bothering to do that? Like, that's just, you know, if you take a step back and look at it, you're not changing anything. In some ways you're hurting yourself. In some ways you are, you know, locking yourself off from access to, you know, things that would be beneficial to you. You know, I get this kind of like criticism sometimes about just the way I run my business, right? It's like, let's make it more abstract. You could imagine it like in the context of a, like a game developer for iOS. Why aren't you, you know, doing such and such like in-app purchases or something? And it might be that like you're so turned off by the ways that people have used in-app purchase for like, you know, upselling like credits and stuff like that to make games easier. It might be that you're like so like indignant about it that you're like, you know what, I just can't even touch in-app purchase. Like, it just doesn't work for me. And I think there's something comparable there where it's like, you know, it doesn't make sense in isolation as like a, you know, Manton versus the world. You're not going to change the world by not being on Twitter. And I don't think you think you are, but you're going to change your world. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, this stuff matters. I mean, if we do everything just based on what's the perfect business sense or what everyone else is doing, yeah, what do we have? I mean, everyone has their own opinion about things, and it's okay to make small statements or hold your ground on certain issues, even though it might not make sense to the rest of the world. And like with an in-app purchase, like you said, I mean, that stuff matters in terms of people's perception, you know, of you, your reputation, what you stand for. I think that's a great example with the game stuff, not falling into that trap, even if you know you could make a boatload of money with certain tactics because you don't feel comfortable with it or you're trying to tackle other bigger problems, right?
Right. Well, speaking of how companies conduct their software development business, just today, Wednesday, we had news from Apple that they are sort of capitulating to the demands. I guess that's a dramatized way of framing it. But in a nutshell, Apple has listened to customers who were disappointed with various shortcomings of iWork 13, and they have, I think, done a pretty unprecedented thing for Apple, which is that they have responded publicly with a list of specific features and feature areas that will be addressed within the next 6 months. And that's just, you know, anybody who has been paying attention to Apple for years knows how strange it is, because Apple's sort of famous for their brevity, for their opaqueness. It seems to me like the old Apple would have at most said, iWork 13 has been the most popular release of iWork ever. We understand a few customers have been disappointed. Right. Which is so... Yeah. And then, you know, suffice to say, we are aiming to, you know, improve the app for future updates, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
In this case, though, you know, they actually say quite a bit. They say...
say a whole lot. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was talking on Twitter, as you do, about some of this stuff. And, you know, Rich Siegel from Bare Bones, our friend at Bare Bones, said... I framed it like it was an apology on Apple's part, because it feels apologetic for any company to offer up, you know, specific promises of improvements to their software on a specific timeline. That feels like they're making up for something to me. But he pointed out that there's no apology. There's no overt apology. It just says, hey, it kind of says like what I was joking about the old Apple saying. It kind of says, hey, this is the best iWork ever. I know that there's some things that we also wish were in there. But then where they differ is they say, some features you can expect in the next 6 months, and they go down by app, pages. We'll get a customized toolbar. We'll get a vertical ruler. You know, and then Numbers and Keynote, they specifically say they're going to improve AppleScript support, which is like, well, some people, like I remember our friend John White on Twitter was sort of saying, well, this is just one more nail in the coffin for AppleScript when iWork 13 came out and had severely diminished, in some cases, I think, completely stripped AppleScript support.
Right. So this is good news for those people who have thought that. That's not the case. Because Apple did make changes. I was about to say improvements. I don't know if that's accurate. But changes to AppleScript and Mavericks, too. I mean, that's still important technology for them.
Yeah.
But the fact that this is such a big list is really interesting. And the fact that they say 6 months specifically. I mean, this is like a product plan. I mean, this is like, I don't know, someone writes this up and gives it to the engineers and say, this is what you're working on for the next 6 months. It's very detailed.
Yeah. And it's the kind of thing that I would specifically advise any software developer, even, you know, including Apple, usually do not make promises like mm-hmm. this, because
right.
you don't know what's going to happen in the next 6 months. There's only two reasonable conclusions I can take away from this. One is Apple has made a foolish promise, and now they are going to either have to, like, you know, abuse their own engineers to make sure it happens on time, or risk the failure to meet the promise. Or, and I hope for Apple's sake this is the case, and I sort of suspect it is the case, or they have all of this stuff already done and it's going to be out in 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
And that's saying it's going to be within the next 6 months is actually covering that, you know, that 1 month.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of this is done already and it was pulled for the release because it wasn't done enough, or it wasn't, you know, comparable across iOS and Mac, you know, whatever the reasons, or the web for that matter. So, I mean, it could be that this is less of a major task than it looks like.
Yeah.
They may be almost all the way through there, like you said. But it certainly is. I mean, you're right. Apple's never quite done anything like this before. The closest thing I can think of is they did have some kind of statement when Final Cut 10 shipped, and a lot of people were up in arms about that. There were major changes. And I think they made some kind of statement that we are going to look at doing something. I can't remember what it was, support for old cameras or FireWire or something. I can't remember what it was, but there were like one or two specific things they said we're going to work on, but nothing like this. And I don't believe anything with a month target like that.
We are living through the era of Apple's greatest successes and their most overt apologies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is not a big deal really in the big scheme of things, but it's sort of up there in that whole, it's part of that era of, you know, apologies for maps. And in this case, you know, like Rich from Bare Bones pointed out, this isn't exactly an apology, but it includes, for example, advice for reverting your documents to the previous version's file format.
Wow.
That sounds like a mea culpa to me. Mm-hmm. You know, on some level, you could just say it's a pragmatic response to try to head off the severity of support backlash that they're having. But even if it is, it's like they, by including this information, how to run, it points out that we have not removed your original iWork. That's kind of telling too. Like the fact that the application installs separately. So they left the old iWork on users' disks. They have advice for how to downgrade their documents. This does not sound like the aftership sort of, these are not the actions of a company that has just like shipped software and feels like it was a complete success.
Right. They're not apologizing, but certainly they are not happy with the situation and the way they shipped it. They are going to be more happy and more excited in 6 months
yes.
than the way the situation is right now. So you kind of read between the lines. It's not an apology, but it's definitely, we're not happy with the way things are today.
Yeah. If you don't make these kind of statements, you don't volunteer this much information. In my opinion, that's what it comes down to. The amount of volunteered information is code for apology.
Right.
Because Apple doesn't volunteer information.
No, most of the release notes just say, like, what, bug fixes? Is that that's the joke, right? There's, like, two words in the whole release notes. Here we have more words than we're used to seeing at all. But that's interesting you said it updates alongside. I hadn't noticed that because I think the other part of this that's unique is that they're pushing these updates much more strongly than they've ever pushed before, right? Free updates on all this stuff. Buy a new Mac, get this stuff free. And they're being very generous about who they upgrade, right? I think even like demo versions were upgraded, whether that was an accent or not, I don't know. But they're really pushing these versions, and it's a little different than if you went into a store and you paid money to upgrade and you looked at the back of the box in the old days, right? And you saw the new features or the features that were removed or whatever. This is, it's pushed, it's automatic. Most people don't even know what the new version has. And so they're surprised when they launch numbers for the first time and things look different and some of their favorite stuff is missing. My wife updated last week or whenever it was, and all of a sudden we're sitting in the office and I hear her say, "What in the world did they do?" Right? I mean, she immediately noticed that the way she was used to working in numbers was completely different, or not completely different, but different enough that she was shocked and clicking around trying to figure out what was different.
Right. That's not the reaction you want.
Yeah.
Especially
exactly.
Not from like, you know, comparable to you and I, maybe naive users, right? It's like,
exactly. So you just imagine that on the full scale of all the users they have and how aggressively they're pushing these updates. It's a big change. And so they obviously feel they need to address it.
Well, here's one interesting thing too. We'll wrap this up, about, you know, iWork, but another thing that came up on Twitter was, somebody, his name is Eli, I think, and his account is EL Saul, ELSAUL. We'll link to him in the show notes, but he pointed out that maybe the change in the whole pricing structure, you know, the fact that it's being given away for free, or, you know, essentially accounted for as a subscription. You know, it's like amortized into the cost of the computer. He speculated that it may not have been legal previously, or maybe not, you know, maybe not wise for Apple to be forthcoming about features that were coming down the road.
Yeah.
So maybe on top of Apple's sort of built-in tendency to be quiet and secretive and not share too much, maybe there has been an actual change in what they feel comfortable sharing because of this change in how the product is sold.
Yeah, I don't know the legal stuff. I feel like Apple they go overboard a little bit with the no free updates thing, and I don't know if some of that holds water, but they have an army of lawyers, so they're going to do what they're going to do.
Well, this week we are happy to welcome back a previous sponsor of the show, Edovia, and their Screens product for iOS. Leave your computer behind and travel light. Screens is a beautiful yet powerful screen sharing and VNC client that lets you connect back to your Mac, Windows, or Linux PC from the comfort of your living room, the corner coffee shop, or anywhere in the world. Screens 3 is a brand new app rebuilt from the ground up that offers many great features such as pasteboard sharing, display selection, a new customizable shortcuts toolbar, and more. Screens is a universal app that requires iOS 7. It is available on the App Store today for $19.99.
Great. Thanks for sponsoring the show. This is probably one of the first in the top few apps that I upgraded when iOS 7 came out. It looks really nice on iOS 7. Has just the right amount. I mean, it matches the look, of course, but has just the right amount of like a little bit blurring here, just really nicely cleaned up. You know, you use it to connect back to your Mac, so you can be in somewhere else or even another room. Like just a couple nights ago, I had a chat or something up on my Mac, and then I was in the living room watching TV, and I actually pulled up my Mac from my phone. And you think like you couldn't like control your Mac from such a small screen, but it actually works really well, and the UI gets out of your way. So you have like a fairly thin like toolbar that you can kind of swipe between to get different commands, and you can customize it. And you can actually work really well, even from a small screen like that. So you're on the go, you need to connect back to your Mac and do something. And really nice app, really well done and really handy to have.
Yeah, I'm always really impressed with Screens. I keep it in a special folder on the front page of my iPhone that's just called Remotes. Mm-hmm. And it has like the whole cascading list of, you know, things that get me into my other Macs, you know, or to my Macs, period. And You know, so like for some things, I can just use the iTunes remote to control music. And some, you know, sometimes then I need to go a little bit hardcore and like, you know, do something from the command line. I use a Panax prompt. But screens is like the, if there's anything on my Mac that I, if there's anything I can't do with another remote, screens will get me there. You know, right. It's like, it is absolutely going to let me access the things I need to on my Mac. And you're right. The UI is like the way it zooms in and zooms out, pans around. And I'm always so impressed with just how fast the rendering is. Granted, I'm often, yeah, you know, on my home network anyway, but, it shows that, a lot of attention I think has been put into making sure that it behaves very quickly. Sometimes when I'm using something like this, I think like, is this really how fast the Mac feels in real life? Like, but you know, you just keep cruise around and you click on fields and you type and it just gets in and out of, you know, where it needs to go very quickly, very effectively. So thanks again, Edovia, for sponsoring the show. Screens 3, folks, you can get it at, you can get more information about it at screensapp.com. And of course you can check it out and buy it on the Apple iTunes App Store.
Okay, well, just before we started recording, I saw the news about VoodooPad. I think you've seen this already, and I've only read half the blog post from Gus, but he is letting VoodooPad go. I'm still looking through and kind of digesting it, but VoodooPad is, what does he say, 11 years old, right? It's a Mac app, great app. I've been using it since probably near the beginning. Although I haven't updated my Mac apps in a while, I would put all my documentation, all my help stuff in VoodooPad and export, to, you know, Apple Help and HTML files, and great app for collecting stuff. And he's selling it off.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, I know Gus well enough that I kind of feel like sad on his behalf to see it get sold. And I know, and I believe him when he says he believes it's the best thing for the app and for him. And I know, you know, some of the folks at Plausible Labs as well. And so I believe them when they say they have great plans for it, but it's one of those things where, Gus is very much like a model for me of like how to approach the whole indie software thing, you know, because he is a single, you know, person who doesn't do consulting, who just makes software and sells it, and who is quite successful at it.
And he had this great blog post. I just looked it up. It's from 2005, How to Become an Independent Programmer in Just 1,068 right. Days. And it's a fantastic post. And I bet if you read it today, it holds up.
Yep.
Where he talks about not specific numbers, but he has a chart in there about, you know, how he was tracking revenue and when he realized it was time to go indie. And so, yeah, he was in that early crop of people when Mac OS X was kind of getting this community going of indie developers. So totally. And so how do you feel about, I mean, he only has two apps, but it's too much, right? He needs to focus just on Acorn. I assume that's the gist of it. How do you feel about it? Is it impossible now for someone to build a couple apps or a few apps and do a good job? Or has the bar been raised so much lately that it really is difficult to maintain more than one thing?
Well, I think it just depends a lot for one thing on the scope of the app. You look at something like Acorn. Yeah. Jesus, it's like closer to, I mean, he's made points over the years of saying it's not trying to be Photoshop, but right. It's getting closer and closer. You know, it's more in the realm of Photoshop than in the realm of, you know,
Microsoft Paint.
Yeah, Microsoft Paint, right.
Yeah. No, apps, and I replaced Photoshop with it, right? I used to be a Photoshop user, and for the last couple of years, I've only used Acorn. So, yeah, he's one guy, and Adobe is however many people. And I think you can make that comparison, even though the apps are very different.
Yeah. And so I have a little taste of this because Mars Edit is also kind of like a bigger scope. And, you know, it tries to tackle a larger feature set and a bigger scope than maybe most one person software projects should. So I think you could make an argument, like, for example, with Acorn, that even if he pairs back his product line to just Acorn, there's an argument to be made that it's still too much for one person. And so I can definitely relate to, you know, my apps, the ones that aren't Mars Edit have, you know, let's be honest, they've suffered for, you know, to some extent over the years. They haven't seen as much development because I really have to put a lot of energy into Mars Edit where I'm making my living. So for example, I've thought for over the years about getting rid of some of the apps or just decommissioning them. And again, getting back to like my sort of empathy for Gus, it's hard for me to imagine doing that. It's even hard for me to imagine like giving up an app, even when I know it would be going to a good home. It's like, it's probably like owning a pet or something, you know? And it's like, just because the pet's going to be happy and well cared for and maybe even have a better life with somebody else doesn't mean that I feel great about giving it up, right?
The other interesting thing about Vudupa is that he's giving it up when it's... I mean, it wasn't that long ago that he did a major new version, I think, unless I'm...
No, I think you're right. I think it was within the last year.
Right. And so it's a little different than, for example, I killed off my app WeTransfer, my little Mac app, a few years ago when it had been neglected for a very long time. You know, people were still buying it, but it was, if you looked at like the release notes and the roadmap for when a new version might potentially come out, it was very clear that that product was really not maintained well. So, which is, I think it's a lot different than Vudupad, where it's almost at the, not at the height of the product maybe, but I would still consider it actively maintained, at least on the surface when you're looking at it.
Yeah.
Which I guess is a great time to let it go, right? Because someone doesn't have to worry that, oh, this project still builds with, you know, Xcode 2 or something.
Right.
It's not ancient.
No, it's a great time to sell it, and it would be a terrible time to just outright decommission it. So, you know, just to put all that work into a major upgrade and then bother with, you know, ironing out all the kinks and then getting it out into customer hands and then say, oh, that's it, closing up that shop. Well, you'd be much better off to do that, to just close up shop on a product right before you would be tempted to put a bunch of time into it, right? But but as far as selling it, yeah, it does seem, you know... probably like a year after an app's last major update is probably about the ideal time to sell it off, because you've enjoyed the benefit of all the revenue associated with that launch. Like there's usually a huge spike compared to the average before the launch. And then, so you've enjoyed all this great revenue boost, hopefully sort of paying you back for the effort that you put into the big release, and then you've enjoyed like a year's worth of that sort of like follow-on revenue, and you have this track record then that shows recent profitability for the app, so that when you go to somebody who's going to take it over and you know, pay you for it and buy it from you, you can say, look, this is a reasonable, you know, app that you can make money off of. And I have proof over the last 12 months, right? but if you wait like 3 or 4 years after the last release and then try to sell it, then you could still be doing reasonable business, but it doesn't reflect what you know the app is capable of selling. And so then you'd have a harder case to make trying to get a reasonable compensation for it, I think.
Well, best of luck to Gus on a... focusing on Acorn. I'm sure he's excited to, just letting go of the weight of worrying about Vudupad. I'm sure he's excited to dive in and work, you know, finish whatever he's doing with Acorn. So, and best of luck to the new owners. It's a great app.
Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of thing where I think we've seen it actually playing out pretty well. These acquisitions to friendly parties and parties that you respect and trust to go far with the software. Marco Arment, of course, has sold several things over the past year, and it seems like those things are, you know, in many cases doing better than he could have expected them to do, you know, with his limited ability to continue developing them. So let's hope that the same thing works out for Acorn. Well, let's hope Acorn continues to do well, but in particular Vudupad and its new home at Plausible Labs, And that those of us who use and enjoy VoodooPad, I'm sure we will have a lot to look forward to as these new fresh eyes get a chance to work with the software.
Yeah. Best of luck to everybody. And thanks, everyone, for listening to the show this week. If you have any comments, feel free to ping us on Twitter or app.net at coreint, or send us email at feedback@coreint.org, or leave a review in the App Store. Not in the App Store, in the iTunes Store, if you like the show.
And don't forget, folks, if you want to have your tweets ignored, just send them to @Manton on Twitter.
Right into DevKnoll. All right. Talk to you next week.
Take care.